Just a couple, only have a couple of things before we begin. I said I wasn't going to say anything more about Kashrus, but two people sent me something, so I'll share it. Moshe, who listens, he's the expert on Rav Chaim Heller. And so he sent me the following thing that appeared in the newspaper Hatzafira in Warsaw. Many of you might know that there was a lot of East European Jews living in Berlin. They're called Ostjuden. If you go to Berlin, the area that's known as Charlottenburg, that's where many of them live. That's where Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg lived. But, you know, how to make a living. So one thing you can open up here, you have hotel, pension, a kosher pension. So if you're in Poland and you're going to Berlin and you're going to stay, you need a place to stay. But in those days, they served you also not just breakfast, they served you dinner. How do you know if it's kosher? So here's the pension, which is located in Artilleriestrasse. Actually, that's on the East Berlin. The Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin is on Artilleriestrasse. So I don't, you can go there today. They changed the name. That was too militaristic. So it's not, now it's called Tucholskystrasse already. That's what they changed it to. I don't know now. They might have gotten rid of that East Berlin name. Although the last time I was there, it still was Tucholskystrasse. But here it says, if you want to know, it says Kasher Berlin. If you want to know, you want Ladas Zos Bederor, you can consult with certain rabbis. And it gives two rabbis who I don't know. But in Lumja, you can consult Rav Chaim Heller. Now, Rav Chaim Heller was Rav in Lumja for a while, just a few months. But he had been in Berlin for a time. He went to the university. So here you have an advertisement stating that if you're going to go to Berlin and you want to know where, you know, if my place is kosher, ask Rav Chaim Heller. He'll tell you that I'm reliable, that I'm the Muchzak B'Kashrus. And that's how, it, as I said, that's how it was done. It never would have occurred in those days, this is the early 20th century, to find a local Berlin rabbi to give a hashkacha, to come into the kitchen and all that stuff. That's not how they worked in those days. You have a Rav like Rav Chaim Heller testifying that the owner of this is a Muchzak B'Kashrus, and then you can all rely on it. And Jonas, or Jonas, I think it's by Jonas Prager, tells me, you should don't say the last name, but I said it. He testifies that in the 1970s, shopping in Borough Park, he was surprised to see Schick's Bakery. Schick's Bakery, which now you can buy their stuff in the stores. He was there and he asked for a Tudah, and they thought he was crazy. Schick's Bakery did not have a Tudah. Everyone just knew that that was a kosher bakery. So thank you, Jonas. I mentioned Moshe, the expert on Rav Chaim Heller. He called my attention to something else that's of interest that has nothing to do with kosher, but it's also the history of American Orthodoxy. It relates to the hotel we've spoken about so much, the Pioneer. And he found a letter from an individual I never heard of, Julius Steinfeld, who you can read about him. He has a Wikipedia entry. He did rescue work during the war. He was an agudist, but somewhat of an extreme agudist from the descriptions that Moshe told me. Not Hasidic, but from Williamsburg. I'm holding a letter here, pages. You can see it. Which is addressed to the leadership of Agudas Yisrael in America. And Steinfeld is very upset. Why? Because he says there's a Malon Echad Gadol, you know, there's this large hotel which publicizes itself as Glatt Kosher Mina Mahadrin and Shomer Shabbos, and what's it called? The Pioneer Country Club. And he says that the owners of this, Chaverim Nichbadim B'Histadrut Agudas Yisrael B'America, that the owners of it are people involved in Agudas Yisrael. You might remember the Jewish press, Leo Gartenberg. There's two owners, Gartenberg and Schachter. Leo Gartenberg used to have a weekly column in the Jewish press. He published a book, I think it was called Torah Thoughts. So what's the problem? He's not complaining. Steinfeld's not complaining about no hashkacha. That was taken for granted. But he says that this hotel, which is supposed to be so frum, and two people, the owners of it, are members of the Agudas Yisrael. What do they have there? He says they have mixed swimming, Bataruvas Bachurim V'Nashim. And he also says that they have dancing. And they even bring in sometimes actresses, he says, and call it Broadway show. That is, they'll have singers. And he says, He says, this hotel is regarded as, quote, he says, strictly Orthodox. Mahadram, but he says, Rahmanu Litzan. He says the rabbis go there and they advertise this. So he says, how can we have, we need to protest this. Why? What do they need to protest? Because they're going to have, he says, the Aguda Convention. The Knessia and the Aguda Sishol Convention is there. And they already sent out, he said, 1,000 invitations from the heads of the Aguda to come there to this Kinos Hashem Shemayim. And it'll be Siri Aguda Sishol and the Shay, the women of Aguda Sishol. And he says, we have to stop this. You can't have an Aguda Sishol convention, not in a place that doesn't have a Shkacha. He doesn't even mention that. But at a place that has shows on the Aguda Sishol weekend, they wouldn't have the shows. And it's probably in the winter, so they wouldn't have any swimming, but it's still a place that has it. So he says, you need to announce Shemavatlim HaConvention Mimakom HaMatuav HaNal. And then he says, whether you abolish the convention entirely or not, certainly you cannot have a convention where you have Gvarim and Seirim V'Nashim. You can't have men and women, unmarried women. You can't have a convention of Gvarim, Seirim, V'Tziros B'Yachad. So people would bring, they would have Seirei Gudas Yisrael. So you'd have the girls, I guess, division and the boys division. And they go, and he says, absolutely, you can't have that. So I think that's interesting. Thank you, Moshe, for sending that to me. This is 1963. One more thing to share with you. A few weeks ago, one of you asked me about Rav Soloveitchik and cheese. And we spoke about cheese. So I want to show you something about a book that just came out, which I just saw this over Shabbos. It's called The Dershowitz Family Saga by Zacharia Dorshov. Dorshov is Dershowitz. And he tells, it's the whole story, not of Alan Dershowitz has the foreword to it. And it's interesting. The guy's a musmach of Rav Chaim Berlin, but he becomes a big Zionist. But from his generation, becoming a Zionist from Chaim Berlin wasn't such a big deal. So let me tell you what it says in this book. And it's a real interesting book about his life, but not just his life, members of his family. At first, I was confused, though. What kind of name is this? Dorshov. Who names it? Where do you name Dorshov? I know what Dorshov is. Dorshov. I'll tell you why Dorshov is, presumably, if Rabbi Zacharia knew what I'm going to tell you now, he never would have named it Dorshov. There's a famous passage in Bamidbar Rabbah, which says, here it is, 23:25, where you have the expression, V'chein kol dor v'dor v'dorashav, dor dor v'shofetav, dor dor amanhigav, dor dor v'farashav, dor dor v'tzadikav. So what's the translation? It says that God showed Moses all that had be, all that will be. He showed him. What did he show him? Then he says he showed him Samson arising from dawn, etc. It was for every generation with its expounders, every generation with its judges, etc. So Dor Dor V'Dorashav means every generation with its expounders. And many of you might recognize the title. That's Isaac Hirsch Weiss, his famous Haskalah type of history of Halacha is called Dor Dor V'Dorashav. But the expression. So here we see Dorashav, its expounders. However, it's a rabbinic expression, which is found in the Chidah many times, but it's found earlier than that in Al-Kharizi, in Leon Modna, in Emmanuel of Rome. Instead of Dorashav like we see it, they spell it Dor and then Shav, Shin, Vav, Aleph. So the expression is, in our generation, Bedorenu, Dorashav. Like a useless generation. So you would say Steinfeld could have said, like, in our generation, Dor Shav, a useless generation, a Gudis Yisrael can have a convention at a hotel that has, mixed dancing. So the expression in rabbinic literature, Dor Shav, is always used to mean useless generation. So I was wondering, what's someone doing naming his book, naming his name when he goes to Israel, Dor Shav? Well, lo and behold, it's not that. It's Dor Shav as in Shin Vet. That is the generation that returns, because his generation was the generation that returned to Eretz Yisrael, and that's why he named it. But if you look on page 415, he speaks about this cheese business. He actually gets it wrong, the reason why the Rav permitted it. I mean, he says that there are no kosher, non-kosher milk-bearing animals on farms, but that there's nothing to do with it. There's nothing to do with a cow is a kosher animal, but a cow has to be shechted. So it has nothing to do with non-kosher bearing animals. It has to do with the vegetarian, the rennet. But he says that he asked Rav Lichtenstein about this issue, and Rav Lichtenstein said that after the Rav's wife passed away, he stopped with the regular cheese because he took upon himself more chumras. He also tells us on page 417 that he spent Shabbos at onset in Cape Cod with the Rav, and this I've never heard before. He says that the Rav would be the Baal Kori, Baal Kriya, technically, read the Torah, and he says that it was very enlightening to see in the middle of his Kriyas HaTorah once, he turned to the Gabbai and asked in English, what's the proper truck? And then the Gabbai told him, and he continued. So first we see he was medakdek, and also he spoke, because some people say you're not supposed to speak in the middle. But I guess whenever you're not supposed to speak, if there's a reason, you can speak. And the Rav obviously felt that Trump was vital. So that's that for the Dershowitz story. Okay, let us continue with our letters. We're up to letter 11. Although I want to revisit one of the letters last week because we had a lot of discussion about this. Let me show you about the Rav's position on apostates. And I quoted from the letter which this man reported, Yisrael Shlomo Ben Meir, Rabbi Dr. Yisrael Shlomo Ben Meir, who was, they said, the Yoshev Rosh of the Knesset. And he had this conversation with the Rav, which passed on to Hatzofeh, and then they recorded it. And I said I didn't know who he was. I had to look him up. I should have done that beforehand. Well, very interesting, first of all. He's the grandson of Rav Yudel Rosenberg, who was the rabbi of Rabbi Kelman Shul. That's the first interesting point, who has many, many descendants. Yudel Rosenberg, what a character. Ira Robinson wrote a book about him last year, but what a character. I didn't even realize that also Rav Itamar Rosenzweig, my son's Rebbe in YU, is descended from him. The Brody family is descended from him. Many. And one of the people descended from him is the Ben Meir family, who was in, I knew the other Ben Meir, this guy's son, Yehuda Ben Meir, who was a Maftal representative for religious Mizrahi for many years. But I didn't realize his father. So what's Meir? Because Yudel Rosenberg had a son, Meir. So this is Yisrael Shlomo Ben Meir. He's actually a YU guy. He's a YU musmach. He goes to Israel in 1952 because he's a member of Knesset. As far as I know, well, I'm certain he's the only YU musmach to ever be a member of the Knesset. But maybe if David Eisen is with us, I would think he's the only YU graduate to ever be a member of Knesset. Am I wrong about this? Now, the article says he went to Yeshiva University and New York University. I think he got his law degree at NYU, but he's a YU musmach. He's a YU graduate and a YU musmach. So that's the one the Rav was speaking to. So I looked up this the Rav's position. I said I was going to look more into it. And first about the Franciscans. One of you said, I looked this up. A brother of Daniel was not a Franciscan friar. I looked it up. You can. There's a few different types of friars. And Augustinians, Carmelites, Dominicans, and Franciscans, and others as well. So it's not he was not Franciscan. I'll check it right now here. He was a Carmelite friar. Yes, I looked it up. Okay, so what I also wanted to mention for those who were here in the past, you remember this, others not. If you want to, a whole article dealing with the Franciscans in rabbinic literature, you can see it here. It's from Sforim Blog, June 20th, 2016. Just Google Mark Shapiro, Engaged Couples, Seirim, and more. Because Franciscans were called Seirim. That's the title they gave them. But I went back to Rav Lichtenstein's article. And Rav Lichtenstein does quote this thing from the Gemara, that from Yavamos, that when it says the lashon from Hosea, Hashem Bagadu, Rav Hartzin quotes that he doesn't quote the business with the Perush HaMishnah that the Rambam quotes. But then I looked up and I Rashimo Shirim of the Rav, published by Rabbi Rachman. Check it out. Yevamos. Perek Yud Zayin Abad Aleph. You have the same thing I told you last class. The exact same thing which Rabbi Ben Meir reported, with one significant difference. In Rabbi Ben Meir's report of it, this chiddush of the Rav, that an apostate is not regarded as a Jew. He's regarded mamish as a goy. He quotes in the name of his father, Rav Moshe. But in the Rishimo Shiurim, it's quoted in the name of his grandfather, Rav Chaim. So, and he speaks, and it's very interesting. He even attaches it. He says this would apply. Rav Chaim also, he quotes him as saying that those people who remained in Spain, the Muranos, would be regarded as goyim 100%, which is not how they generally regarded them in the post scheme of the time. And then the Rav, after quoting this, says, "Vahu chidush nora," that this is a chiddush. So the question we had last class was, is this something that other poskim would accept, that Brother Daniel was regarded as a goy, a complete goy? I said, I didn't know. But here the Rav seems to acknowledge that he says it's a chiddush. It's Reb Chaim's chiddush, and he said Reb Chaim's point is that if the goyim also regard you as a goy, and you regard yourself as a goy, then you're a goy. So anyone who's interested in it, you can check out the Rishimos of the Rav. So the last class, we also spoke about the missionaries, and David Eisen clarifies that in Israel, it's only a crime to missionize children, but not adults. That's thank you, David, for that. Now, Ben, you ask a good question, which we're going to get to right now or in a minute. Ben wants to know, where does the Rav, you know, how is it that the Rav is giving his opinion on what's going on in Israel? And don't we usually say, unless you're living there, you shouldn't give your opinion? And did they listen to the Rav? So let's hold off on that, because we're going to see the Rav comments on this today. We'll get to that. So we're picking up now letter 11. As I told you, there's 21 letters, but then a few of you have asked me if I could comment on some of the letters of the Helfgott book. So if Rabbi Kelman gives his approval, we'll spend a few weeks on some important letters in the Helfgott book. But the letter 11 is also to Mr. Goldschlag, Mizrahi leader. It deals with the ship. You see that this is such a big deal. In fact, in this letter, the Rav says that we're going to have to declare an announcement, a big isser. And he says, if we make a compromise, this will completely destroy our movement. You see what a big deal it was. Today, it's hard to understand why it was such a big deal. He goes on to say, he said that this ship, Hafra Arkas of the Masana, he says, it's like a Harid Vayava. They say that you can't even change your shoelace in a time of a persecution. And the Rav says that this whole ship thing, that we have to make a stand on this. You know, they already put themselves out there. Elofying on Shabbos wasn't the issue here, but that you can't have a kosher and a non-kosher kitchen. So the Rav, again, stresses this matter, and just more of the same, how if anyone wants to write something on the history of this Shipla and the Orthodox response, this will be an important letter as well. But it doesn't really repeat anything more than we've already seen. At the end of the letter, he throws in a comment there, which when we deal, I guess, with the Helfgott book, we can go into more detail, where he just refers to something that the church is doing, some declaration. This before Vatican II, the church's declaration of Vatican II, and the Rav says that this ecumenical declaration, which in the end was not announced, I'm not sure, maybe some preliminary version of it, he says that it was a complete evangelical statement. And we're going to see this again, that evangelizing statement, that the Rav was very suspicious of Vatican II. He was very suspicious of, although he obviously wanted the Catholics to tell their people you know, that we're good and you don't have to discuss things like that. But this idea that we're supposed to get together, interfaith, all that, he saw an evangelizing, a missionary element in that, which we'll get back to. Letter 12, we can skip again. It's just it's a small, he says, this is to Rabbi Kirschblum in English. He simply says, I'll read it. The introduction of a double menu on an Israeli boat under governmental auspices will have a corrosive effect upon many American institutions. So again, the ship with treif and kosher, that's something we need to take a stand on. If we have any people who were involved, this is from the 60s, who know about why this, again, why was this such a big deal for Mizrahi? Granted, they're in the government, but we have El Al, there's Chil Shabbos going on in the state of Israel left and right. Why this becomes such a symbolic thing, I'm not sure. That takes us to letter 13. Letter 13 is also to Goldschlag, and again, deals with issues of religion and state in the state of Israel. For the Haredi world, today they do get involved with this, but years ago it wasn't such a concern for theirs, because for them the state is just something that enables them to live in Eretz Yisrael. But for the religious Zionists, the state has always been a problem, because they view the state as sort of the fruition for Eschalta Teguva. Let's put it that way, and the fruition of all these religious Zionist efforts. Well, that creates a problem, because how could you have a state that's a Eschal Teguva if the people running the state are irreligious? Now, granted, today you have plenty of people running the state who are religious. But in the 50s and the 60s, it was completely irreligious and a leadership. So how could that be a Eschal Teguva? And the state's doing all sorts of things against Halacha. So that's a problem for the religious Zionists, and they have their theology. They come up with their ways of dealing with it, and you can cite all sorts of. Rav Kasher is very much involved with it. You know, Chazal look at some of the terrible kings of Israel, and they still attach to them certain benefits. So that was always the Haredi attack on religious Zionism. How can you give such a state significance when they're trying to draft women and they're not Shomer Shabbos, all of that? Okay, so that's a religious Zionist issue, and that's why the Rav and all the Mizrahi are very concerned with it. And Ben, the question you asked, the Rav is going to really deal with it right now. And he writes to Goldschlag. Now, remember, the Rav is in Chutz Aretz. He's not living in Israel, but he's the head of Mizrahi in America. And there's a great deal of respect for the Rav, for the old-time Mizrahi people who are now in Europe. Many of them knew the Rav from Berlin, and they knew him from Warsaw. Everyone also knew that the Rav had sacrificed, the Rav had suffered for Zionism. I heard from Professor Tursky that it wasn't just me. I mean, he gave a talk was it the Yurt site? I forget now. He said that had the Rav not joined with Mizrahi, the Aguda would have made him the Godo Hador for them. They would have made him. And at the time, I thought that maybe it's a bit of an exaggeration, because, there were other problematic things with the Rav from their perspective. The fact that he's so associated with Yeshiva University, a secular education. But the more I think about it, that they would have found a way, because he had plenty of Haredi Rabbanim who taught at the Yeshivas Rebbe Zalchanan. That never was a psul for them. So if Rav Soloveitchik was an Agudist, and remember, Rav Soloveitchik used to be an Agudist. Rav Soloveitchik's eulogy for Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski is the best expression of the Das Torah ideology ever composed. It's better than any of the Haredim. They'll tell you that. He put the ideology out there, but he later would abandon this idea, Rav Hussein says. But if you want to see what Das Torah is about, you have to read the Rav's eulogy for Rav Chaim Moshe. So had he remained, the fact is that Yeshiva's Rebbe Zalchanan would have been neither here nor there. The fact that he believed in secular studies, that's not such a look. You had German Orthodox rabbis who believed in it. But if he would have been a theoretician and an ideologue for the Aguda ideology, they would have made him the Gadol. No question about it. I think Professor Tversky was absolutely correct. And that's really the issue that the you know, and the Ruff suffered because of this. He was sort of thrown out of certain circles. I have to say, with all due respect, I was at the Ruff's funeral, and you could hear it online. You know, when you can listen to Revara and Soloveitchik's eulogy, there was only one hesped at the Ruff's funeral, Revara and Soloveitchik. It was a very interesting hesped. You should listen to it. I believe it's also been transcribed, because Revara, first of all, he thanked the late Atira Torsky publicly for all she did for the Rav. And I heard her son, Rabbi Meir, in his Motzei Shabbos, I guess, before they went to Israel, his talk about his mother, and he said that she said afterwards that really it was my husband also who should have been given the thank you. I can mention, by the way, regarding Atira, I didn't mention this last time, when I was living in Boston, this is in the early 90s, she would give Rabbi Seth Farber, now he's known in Israel for what he does, he started this organization for women's Torah study in Boston. They called it Ma'ayan. At the time, I didn't know what I know now. You've heard me say it. I should have told him it's Mayan. It's not Ma'ayan. But so I taught for it, and Atira Torsky taught. She taught Gemara. It was women only, and it was, I remember she taught Lulav HaGazel. So I asked Seth Farber once, I didn't know she learned Gemara. He said, of course, she went with her Abba. And so she taught Gemara. But, okay, now I lost my train of thought why I was speaking about that. So Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik at the funeral, he says, I'm not going to criticize the right wing. He says that if I was in their shoes, I might have responded the way they did, which, with all due respect to Revara, I think he's letting him off too kindly. Because Revara, I have to say, if you were in their shoes, you wouldn't have done that. Because at the end of the day, what the right wing did cannot be excused. You can have a dispute over, not all the right wing, far from it, but you can have a dispute over Hashkafic matters, and you can disagree with the Rav. But referring to him as JB and all the negative things they said, no, that's over the line. And you're too kind, Revara and Soloveitchik. They don't need to be defended from that. And what they did at the funeral, the way they boycotted the funeral. So, and it's much different today. Today, they never would speak like that, because there are many people from the students of the Rav who are in that world and have created a change in the right wing's mentality. But then Revara says, and why were they so opposed to my brother? Why did they attack him so? Because he taught a little Kuzari? Because he taught a little Chovos Levavos? I have to say that that's not why they were opposed to him. If that was what he was teaching, that wouldn't have been the issue. And even if Revara was speaking in terms of secular studies, that wasn't the issue, really, with Zionism. And if you look at Rav Shach's attack on the Rav, it's about Zionism. And it's more than Zionism. It's about the fact that the Rav chose to diverge from the Das Torah of the Aguda Rabbonim, a group he had been part of. And that's always worse when you're part of a group and then you leave of it. And Kal Vachomer, he comes from the family, the big anti-Zionist family. He comes from a Chaim, Ravelvo. If such a person, for that is betrayal in their mind. Not only does he break with the other Gedolim, but he breaks with his grandfather, he breaks with his uncle. Really, he doesn't break with his father, though. You know, his father, Rav Moshe, taught that the Mizrahi Tachamoni. Rav Moshe was not an Agudist, and Rav Moshe was not, so he really, even Rav Moshe was more moderate. But okay, so the Rav suffered for this. So the people in Israel, the Mizrahi people, understood this, and they respected him, and they turned to him with their questions. It wasn't like the Rav made announcements and said, I'm going to give you my opinion. Mizrahi leaders, not all of them, but many Mizrahi leaders in Israel, turned to the Rav and asked him his opinion. So if you're asking him his opinion, then he's allowed to speak. And he continues speaking, even when they didn't ask him about Sabra and Shatila. He was the one who called them and said, you need to, I think he said, it's reported, that if they don't demand that a commission of inquiry be established, that he's going to resign as honorary president. He was very strong. Now, the religious Zionists of today, the ones who are currently religious Zionists, the followers of Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the ones that we all know, in a million years, they never would have asked the Rav his opinion. He's living in Chutzparitz. They don't have any connection. It's a different type of religious Zionism. But the religious Zionism pre-1967, and for the old-time Mizrahiites, post-67, they would turn to the Rav. So here you have a letter from the Rov to Goldschlag. And he says, in the letter, in explaining his opinion, he says, my decision to express my opinions does not come bekalos rosh. I don't take this lightly. He says, I consulted with myself, that's me, and also with my students, and also with members of the RCA. And it's only, he's speaking about the fact there that, you know, doesn't speak with the particular detail here, but some other thing that the secular government is doing. He says that, he gets upset even. He says, if the secularists there, if they don't want Nisuin, that is, they don't want to be together with us, that is, the religious Zionists, we will get a get Praetorian and Levatel to Nisuin. Don't threaten us. Let the Mapai say that he wrote some Medina Chilonit. You know, so the Rav, he recognized what Mapai was, what the secular Zionists were. And it's difficult, you know, to be part of a government. You know, there's constant fighting. But you see, the Rav understands what's going on, but it's worth fighting. It's worth the fight, because if you can put religious values into the state of Israel, then it's worth it. Yes, you have to sit with these people, and you have to listen to all their heresies and all these things, but it's worth it if you can accomplish. And the Rav said so. Well, you'll see what the Rav says. But he has no illusions of what he's dealing with, and he expresses his opinion only because he's been requested and he's consulted. And then he says, by the way, in the middle of this letter, this is Nisan, so figure April of 1964, he says, regarding my visit to Israel this summer, I wrote that if my wife feels up to it, we'll attempt to come. He doesn't just say come to Israel. Eretz Chemdas Avosai. And as we heard already from Nikki, that she was ill and therefore they couldn't go. But the Rav often said he was going to go. Now, he doesn't say it here. We'll see later where he says it, that he says that if there's any Torah in Israel at all, it's because of our movement, religious. In fact, actually, we'll see it today. We'll see it in two more letters. That's what makes it worth it. Because of what we're going to see. Adkan, letter 13. Now we get to letter 14, and letter 14 is a different type of letter. What is the purpose of a Rav, of a rabbi? Those who've been with me have heard me say it again and again. The Rav said it, but he quoted, but others have said it. Reb Chaim said, what's the purpose of a rabbi? You're going to say today, you ask the average person, the purpose of a rabbi is to give shiurim. Would it surprise you if I told you Reb Chaim did not give shiurim? There were some yeshiva bachrim he would give shiurim to, but he never gave shiurim to the Baal Batim. Can you imagine a rabbi today in America or Canada? They hire him, he's not going to give shiurim. That's his job. Also, you might say give sermons. Give drushas, sermons, whatever you want to call it. Would it surprise you if I told you that Reb Chaim never spoke, never gave drushas? He didn't, and Revelvel didn't either. So now you're thinking, so what's this? You have a rabbi, you paid a salary. He doesn't learn. He doesn't teach the community. What does he need to teach the community? There's not a Tamid Chachamim. He doesn't darshan. What does he need to darshan for? You have Magi Mesharim who can darshan. He didn't even paskin shilas for the community. So here you have a rabbi. He doesn't, who paskined? He had a dayan, which he brought in from Simcha Zelig. He learned in the Volozhin Kollel. He was the dayan. So here you have a rabbi, doesn't paskin shilas, doesn't give drushas, and doesn't teach the community. So why would any community pay for such a salary for a rabbi? Well, from the community's perspective, the answer is obvious. Because think of the glory to have Reb Chaim as your rav. The community will bask in his greatness, that here you have this Gadol B'Yisrael. So that's the community. But Reb Chaim, he's not just there to bask in his brilliance. Reb Chaim said the job of a Rav, not to teach, not to answer shilas. We have a dayan, not to give drushas. You have a magid, and not to learn with people. You have other people. It's to take care of the widows and the orphans, take care of the unfortunate, take care of the people. That's his job. To make sure if there's a woman who gets pregnant out of wedlock, you know, they leave the children at the door of Reb Chaim. I need to find a place for them to be raised. If there's even a Bundist who's taken away, he'll stop davening on Yom Kippur to raise the money, you know, to free him. A Bundist, an anti-religious. If there's someone sick, Reb Chaim will make sure that there's food there. It's, in other words, that's the job of the Rav. The job of the Rav is to take care of his congregants. He's not hired as a posse. He's not hired as a magichir. He's hired as a Rav. Some rabbis today recognize that. Other rabbis, though, that's like the last thing they want to do, to visit the sick. It's like it's Bittul Torah. It's all that. Okay, maybe it is Bittul Torah from there. That's not their personality. They're not people persons. Reb Chaim was a big people person. And I want to show you something which I found a few weeks ago when I saved it, because I think it's interesting. JTS put Hebrewbooks.org is where you find books online, many books. But they also put on, they have something called HebrewManuscripts.org, and JTS put on many of their manuscripts. So I want to show you something here. I just happened to see it, and I thought of Reb Chaim, because this is a 19th century kina. They, in Italy, they are very good on the Hebrew. Whenever people got married or died, they'd write these pages. And they publish it. And I don't know who this rabbi was, Yehuda Aryeh Osimo. He was the rabbi in Padua, in Italy. Padua, of course, is a big city. It's a city of Shadal, and Shmuel David Sato, and Ramchal, the Marami Padua, Gadol Yisrael there, scholars. But this is a 19th century rabbi. Never heard of him. But in the Kina, look how he's described. He's saying, Benos Padua. You know, daughters of Padua, wear sackcloth and mourn him. Why should you mourn him? Yehuda lukach veinenu. Avi yetomim einoditanu. Look how he's described. He's described as the father of the orphans. Later on, he's a roe nema. Nishpat evyonim shama aznecha. Valev nitkaim diber picha. That is, the unfortunates. He's not described here as a darshan. He's not described here as a poseg or anything. He's described the very way that Reb Chaim described the rabbi, the job of the rabbi to take care of the people. So why do I mention this? Because the Rav was like that also. We don't usually know that because we're not from Boston and we're not part of that. People know the Rav as in his New York incarnation. Although it's well known that when he'd get on the plane and go back to Boston, he'd feel he's back to normality because New York was always very tension-filled. He even said once, according to Robert Kefet, that he feels like he's in a jungle. You know, lots of wild animals in New York. You know, you go back to Boston and it's more calm. And in Boston, he's relaxed and he's the rabbi, the Rav of the community. And as the Rav, and he's the posek, of course, for his community. He's not the only posek, not the only rabbi in Boston, but he's the communal Rav, and more. That's his home. He could have moved to New York, but he remained in Boston. And as the rabbi in Boston, his job is to do what Reb Chaim said, to take care of his people. Well, he did take care of his people. First of all, he took care of his people in a way that lives on long after him. He set up the school in an era where, you know, in a place like Boston, the idea of a day school was so foreign from people's minds, even from the Shomer Shabbos, you know, send their kids to a day school. You know, the Hebrew schools were enough. They wanted their kids to, you know, become American. So he had to fight against that attitude and to create this day school and then high school. He did that. But he also did other things as well, obviously, as a rabbi. He functioned as a communal Rav. And that's the next letter, which I found. And the letter, I didn't know who this person was first I'm talking about. He writes, but I'll show you now. The letter concerns, and I had a nice conversation with the subject of this letter. The letter concerns this individual. Those who are from Boston will know the family. Alan Solomon, former ambassador to American ambassador to Spain and Andorra. A big Democratic activist. He was a national finance chairman, you can see, of the DNC, raising over $40 million. Also serves on the boards of numerous organizations, New Israel Fund, a lot of liberal organizations, but big philanthropist. And so what does this have to do with the letter of the Rav? So let me share the letter of the Rav. So when I first saw this letter, I wanted to get the details of it because it didn't have the date. And I just was curious. So my uncle, who knows everyone in Boston, all the machers, especially if it's in hospital healthcare and democratic politics. So he put me in touch with Alan Solomon, and we had a very nice conversation. So I got the history, and you'll get some of it now from the letter. I mean, if you're in Boston, you know the Solomon family, you know, very involved with Maimonides. But the Rav, now Alan Solomon told me that this is the summer of 1971. He had no idea about this letter. And even though Alan Solomon's from the later generation that didn't become religious, like his parents and siblings, great respect for the Rav, and that's what he called him. But the letter is as follows. Summer of 1931. The Rav writes to Goldschlag, and he says that a son of an important member of our community is now in Israel. And he's at this kibbutz, Kfar Blum. He says that he grew up in a house which was not Orthodox, and now he's searching for meaning, that sort of thing. And the Rav says, in the meantime, his family, due to the influence of the yeshiva, the Maimonides yeshiva, has become religious. However, unfortunately, Alan, who I guess is the oldest, he already went to sleep. He didn't go to Maimonides, so he wasn't able to be influenced, so he's not observant. But the Rav, you know, is still very close to the family and saying, he's in Israel now. What can we do to help him, to bring him in? He's looking in Eretz Avos. He's trying to find himself as a young man in Israel. So the Rav says, Ani me'onyan ma'ot. I'm very concerned, very interested that this young man, Alan Solomon, spent time at a religious kibbutz. We need to expose him to Torah. He says, I spoke to his father, and he's very happy with this opportunity because he also wants his son to become religious. It's, I guess, a difficult circumstance. You know, the kid, you know, sometimes you have it when parents become religious, but the kids are already older. So, you know, the kids aren't necessarily brought along. And the Rav says that the younger sons already went to Maimonides, and therefore they're observant. But unfortunately, the older son didn't go there. Can you request from one of the religious kibbutzim to invite him to stay there for a month or more or less? Mi yodea. Who knows? Maybe going to this kibbutz will affect him to change his life. And then it gives his address. So here you see the Rav, who is so involved with so many different things, not just with what's going on in Boston with all the people and New York with all the shiurim and all the organizations and the people calling him in the letters. He's still involved, interested in the young, let's see, 1949. So this in 1971. So a 22-year-old young man looking the Rav. The Rav is interested, and he's doing what Rav Chaim said. You know, you take care of members of your community. And I think that's, we have all these highfalutin letters, the Rav expressing advanced philosophical ideas. But here you have a letter, a very simple letter. There's someone in our community, his son. I want to, bring him to a religious kibbutz. I want to try to influence him. So that's a different side of the Rav that we don't always see. Since we mentioned the Tara Trusky, I'll mention something else that Tara said after her father died. She gave a talk in Boston and a eulogy. It wasn't so much a eulogy, it was reflections. And she said, told this following story, that they had a maid in their house, a non-Jewish maid for a number of years. And when she retired, when the housekeeper was elderly, the Rav went to the machers of the community. She didn't have Social Security. And the Rav put together a financial package, like a pension sort of thing, so that she'd be taken care of. Now, this is not something, if Atara never mentioned it, no one would know about it. And, the Rav's reputation is only as a great intellectual, a thinker. But here you get a different side of him that we know that just to be a thinker is not enough. He wouldn't be the Rav if he was just a thinker. You need to also have that other element. And there's other stories as well. In that talk, Atara told this story. I think it's also very good. She said that her daughter, so that would be the one from Riverdale, brought a friend home from college. I'm not sure. I know the sons went to Harvard. I guess the daughter went to Harvard also. Tara Torsky also went to Harvard. She has a PhD. She wrote about the dealing with the Civil War. I know. I think it's antebellum attitudes towards the blacks or something like that, related to the South. But this is so the Rav starts speaking to the daughter's friend, and the daughter, well, she was like about she balas tshuva, and the Rav said to her. You can, by the way, this is online. You can listen to this. This was taped. It's online somewhere. You can see it. The Rav said to the girl, you know, because the Rav was speaking, the girl was speaking to the Rav, you know, how to deal with her parents, you know, because now she's religious. There's obviously there's issues. Maybe she can't eat in her house, that sort of thing. And the Rav said, never make your parents feel like they raised you inappropriately. And that's a, that's also, you know, that's that shows the Rebbe Soloveitchik's, I think, insight. We have people, you know, who are Baal Tshuva. And the Rav is saying, never make your parents think they raised you improperly. Fine, now you're religious, but your parents did the best they could do for what they knew, and you're adopting a different path, but don't make them think they erred in how they raised you. So you have, you know, stories like this where you see the other side of the Rav. So I like this letter very much, and I thank Alan Solomon for, I think we were on the phone maybe like 40 minutes or so, and because he was giving me recollections of his father's relationship with the Rav and even his relationship with the Rav. I thank you, Alan, for that. And he didn't know about this letter at all. When I told him about this, he was shocked. He had no idea that the Rav wrote such a letter. We're going to see another letter where the Rav similarly is involved with the families. Letter 15. I'll get to your letter in a minute. And a question soon. Letter 15. This will be, I guess, maybe the last letter we do today. This is a letter to a Mizrahi leader, Yisrael Gantzvi. This is his name. Not a household name, but another Mizrahi leader. And this letter is of interest. It's a number of a num. It's a num. There's a number of letters where the Rav sets forth the same position in Helfgott's book as well. You see a few of them. The Rav would criticize on various occasions Mizrahi in Israel, what the political party was doing there. He'd criticize it to his friends. He criticized in letters, and on occasion, he'd even offer public criticism at Mizrahi conventions. And this often led people to say, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik's going to leave Mizrahi. He's going to leave Mizrahi. And the Rav has to write letters again and again to the heads of Mizrahi. No, I'm not leaving Mizrahi. I'm committed to Mizrahi. This is my organization. I see the value of it. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to agree with you on everything. That doesn't mean I'm not going to express criticism. But you see how afraid the people in Israel were. Because, look, the Agudas Yisrael, they have lots of Gedolim. Mizrahi has Gedolim too, but not so many as the Aguda. But they don't need so many, because if you have the Rav, you know, one Rav equals, you know, five of their Gedolim. I have to say it in terms of significance of, you know, not just a halachic figure, a posek, a theologian, a Talmudist. I mean, at the end of the day, the Rav is, I mean, you know, you can't measure the Rav. So they're very nervous. If the Rav were to leave them, it would be a disaster. So they're constantly writing to the Rav, you know, what are these? We hear that you're not happy with us. Are you still going to remain Mizrahi? And the Rav must have found it so foolish. Why can't you criticize? So here we have another of these letters. And when we do the Helfgott book, maybe we'll see a few more of them. But listen to what he says. He says, first of all, I received your letter, and I have to say that it caused me great distress. And, you know, why are you writing? Why are you forcing me to respond this way? You know, this these things. You know, why are you believing these things that you hear that I need to respond to you? He says, "Hayachasim beini uvein hatnua, my connection to Mizrahi remains the way it was and will remain that way." It'll not just be mitukan that is proper, but it'll be heartfelt, full of yedidut, friendship. He says, "Hishtaychuti ritnuatenu," my connection to our movement. Remember, this is the movement that he breaks with his family tradition. He gives the famous drasha explaining what gives him this right, why he would break with his family Masorah. And he says there, because it is God himself has decided that the Mizrahi approach is right. He says that my connection to our movement expresses a zikah p'nimit, an inner connection. He's not just connected to it for outer reasons. This is like a spiritual connection. He says our sisma, our slogan, which I believe he's referring to, you can only refer to Mizrahi slogan, Eretz Yisrael, you know, the land of Israel, for the people of Israel, according to the Torah of Israel. You know, that's the Mizrahi slogan, land of Israel, for the people of Israel, for in accordance with the Torah of Israel. He says that this slogan, interestingly, these few words, expresses everything we need to know, that, you know, the battle of the religious to make holy secular life. That's what they're doing in Israel. And this is what guides us, he says. Now, he says it's true that on occasion, I don't agree with the political stand that the movement takes. You know, if the Rav was alive today, or if Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was alive today, well, I mean, you saw it with Rav Aaron, because Rav Aaron basically, he broke with Mizrahi. Mrs. Lichtenstein was even on the list for the liberal religious Zionist party, Maimad. But I mean, I hate to say it because I don't want to get political. But if the Rav was around today, seeing what the religious Zionist party in Israel has become, I mean, the official religious Zionist, he would have no part of this whatsoever. He would say, we either need to have a new religious Zionist party or just vote for regular. What do you need a religious Zionist party for? At the end of the day, you can vote for regular parties and they can express a religious Zionist interest. But the Mizrahi had this ideology that we will have a religious Zionist party. But what it's become is very far from what the Rav believed. But he said that there are times when politically, I'll disagree. However, these chiluke deot, these differences that we have, are temporary differences. Bein achim ledea, that we believe one thing. He says these differences that we have don't create a break. No, he says, if I was living in Israel, I would express my opinion openly. You know, see what happened was the Mizrahi people would often hear that the Rav expressed in a letter or in a private gathering. He says, if I lived in Israel, I'd express my opinion openly. However, as someone who lives in Chutz Aretz, he says, I don't have permission, he thinks, to get involved in the politics of Israel. When they come and they ask him, he'll give his opinion. But to publicly express himself, he's not going to sit there in New York or Boston and publicly say that what Mizrahi is doing now is incorrect. However, but privately, he sometimes will do this. Then he says, this one thing he says, I know. Now, pay attention very carefully to this, because this is something that people forget. They don't remember. But when you look at the beginning of the state, think of 1940s, 1950s, everything that, you know, religious education, all the important things. He says, without our movement, religious Jewry, he calls it Yahadut Haredit. Haredit for him means Orthodox. Haredi as a separate group, that's not a term they use there. He said that without our movement, Orthodox Jewry would not have chela v'nachla b'vinyan ha'aretz t'kumat ha'medina. If you took away religious Zionism, what would you have there? You wouldn't have the whole religious school system, which is set up. The fact that you have religious, you can be kosher in an army. The fact that there's any religion whatsoever in the state of Israel is due to Mizrahi. The Haredim don't care about that. They just cared about their own people. Oh, they care about the Haredim. Be very happy to be in the government just to get as much money as they can so they can set up their places in Jerusalem, Bnei Brak. They don't have a concern, Mamlachtiyut. They want money for their school systems, but they're not concerned with the other, with the general community. Maybe today they are. In those days, they certainly weren't. And he says, and he goes on and says that, you know, this is of historic significance. And he says, just to recognize this, what we accomplished is enough for me to be connected to our tnuwa, shehitzila et kavot hayadut lemana bitkufa machriya kazo. Our movement, religious Zionism, saved the Torah for this new state. Now, today, people don't realize this. They don't know what it was like at the beginning. And it's easy to look at the religious Zionist movement now and not see it as significant. But if you know what was going on in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, you know that there was only one organization that was fighting for Torah in the public sphere, in the public square. And that was the religious Zionists. The Haredim didn't care at all. In fact, the Haredim in those days wanted nothing to do with the Batei Dinim in Israel. There was a Cherem on Hilchos Shlomo. There's a Cherem on being part of the Batei Din. So only Mizrahi was doing that. So the Rav recognizes this. And the fact that he disagrees with certain things, that doesn't take away from the fact that I recognize, he says, the historic significance of what religious Zionists was able to accomplish. And then he ends the letter and saying, I just want to add one thing. I saw in Hatzofeh, is a famous picture of the Rav reading Hatzofeh. They would send him Hatzofeh. Hatzofeh was a daily, actually, but only once a week. I think it was Thursday or Friday. It had a big issue where they had book reviews, all sorts of good stuff in it. The Rav published a number of pieces there. He says, I happened to see in Hatzofeh that in a certain newspaper, it has a report that when I spoke to Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion came to America and he spoke to the Rav, he says that I supported separation of Dat and Medina, synagogue and state. And the Rav says, absolutely not true. We never touched this. He says that in the question and answer with the reporters, one of them wanted to give such an explanation to my statement. But he says what I said and what I affirmed is that I am in favor of separating religion and state, but separating the rabbinate from the ministry of religion. So that's the Rav felt that the rabbinate has to be independent. It cannot be an arm of the ministry of religion. That's going to have an impact, as we'll see in one of the other letters. It's amazing that the letters I got, which I just happened to collect, they touch on so many important elements of the Rav's life. We've already seen it. There's a few things they don't touch on. For example, teaching Talmud to girls. I don't have any letters about that, but we'll see in the Helfgott book. But all the other big issues, I think, for the Rav, or at least most of the big issues, I just happened to find these letters, and it shows you that these were the things that people were asking about and the Rav had in his mind. So the Rav says, I am not opposed to separation of synagogue and state. I am opposed of the rabbinate being attached to the government, because when the government has its hands in the rabbinate, then the rabbinate can't be free. And the Rav always held that the rabbinate needs to be free. And at least ostensibly, that's the reason why the Rav refused to become chief rabbi. I say ostensibly because we'll have to examine it in a little more careful detail in a few more letters, where we'll pick up next class with letter 16. So let me take a look at the comments here. So Frankel says he remembers seeing Shoshana Tamari perform, I guess, at the Pioneer. Tamari, I don't know who she was, but it's hard for people today to appreciate this. I mean, that was a religious hotel, but the idea that you're going to have a hotel which didn't have mixed dancing, didn't have dancing. In those days, dancing was a big deal. It didn't have swimming. And that the Frum are not going to go to such a hotel. They don't have to go swimming, but they would go to the hotel. That's something that it's just incomprehensible then. It just wasn't a hava mina. The young generation doesn't appreciate that, but the older can. I still remember as a youth being at Grossinger's, and there was a rabbinic convention when I was in Grossinger's. I don't know if it was an RCA convention or what. I think the RCA used to go to the homework. But there was a rabbinic convention at Grossinger's, and I still remember one of the rabbis. He was actually a rabbi in my town. His name was the late Rabbi Hillel Horowitz. He came for the comedian night, And there was a comedian, and the comedian told some off-color jokes, and he got up and walked out. But I mean, that's what it was. And Rabbi Kalman says Rav Yudel was the inventor of the golem, and also Mordechai Richter's grandfather. Yes, he has big yichus, many descendants. I spoke to one of the grandchildren about a great-grandchildren, because Rav Yudel is a problematic character. He's also a forger, and he's an interesting character. Nissen says that makes Ben Meir a first cousin of the author of Dodi Kravitz. Indeed. And Yaakov says, fascinating oral tradition by Schneer Lyman, Yonah Rosenberg. Yes, and now you can see all the material in Ira Robinson's book. I also wrote, you can go on the Sfarim blog, I have a long piece on Yonah Rosenberg, which Ira cites in his book. And Lyman uncovered something interesting in the Montreal archives, that when they honored Rav Yudel Rosenberg, because he left Toronto and he went to Montreal. And he's a posek also. He wrote a book on Maseches Nedarim. He's the first one to deal with electricity on Shabbos. And he had correspondence with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on this. When they honored him in his 70th birthday or 75th birthday, and he prepared, I guess, the biography of himself, what he's done, he has a section of his halachic writings, and he has a section of folk literature. So all this stuff about the golem and everything is included in the folks literature section. And as I showed in my piece, he hints to readers that this, I wouldn't call it a forgery, that this is like stuff he made up. Because he talks about Arthur Conan Doyle's, you know, and if you know who Arthur Conan Doyle is, you know that he's not writing real history. And he makes it seem, so he gives hints so that the people in the know will know that he's just doing a good story.
A novel. A novel, like his famous grandson was a novelist.
Yes, exactly. So he's trying to give them hints that he's giving people, the Orthodox community needed literature. So he gives it to them. Having said all this, and that's without a doubt, first of all, he calls himself folks literature, he calls it, but I show that he gives these hints to let the people in the know that he's, you know, and these fake libraries, the Library of Metz, which never existed. So he's saying he discovered it. It's like the Three Musketeers, you know, the beginning of it. There's this whole genre that you uncover this, you find this manuscript at this library that tells a story. So he's giving you the hints that this is all made up. Having said that, though, and the great-great-grandson agreed with me, he said, absolutely right, but the great-grandson also agreed there's a problem, because he invented the Maharal, the fifth cup, you know, the Passover Haggadah of the Maharal, he invented, what's that about? And he invented a few tshuvas of the Gaonim. So what's that about? You know, that clearly is not, at least unless I'm missing something here, that's not like a tale or something. He's putting forth halachic tshuva, which he invented, and the whole thing of the fifth cup of kosher, he thought it was an authentic maharal, and he makes a big deal about this. You know, the idea, should you have a fifth cup or not? That's a machokas. We leave it in the middle of the table. When Eliyahu Navi comes, we'll ask him. So until then, we leave it in the middle. But so the maharal, he has this. So what's that about? Is he just having fun with us? I don't know. But to call him a forger, it's more complicated than that. I know he's been called a forger, and he gives hints. There's a lot to discuss about him. Yes, so Nissa mentions also the talk by Professor Lyman. You can hear it online. Ben Melech, that's my relative, Melech. For them, the non-Zionist religious Haredi, the state is a piggy bank to abuse, not a partnership where one studies, but the schar is shared. What I would say is things have changed a little. Today, the Haredi world, much of it sees themselves as having a share in it and being part in it. It's not like it used to be. You know that for who they vote for, and many of them feel a connection, and it's different. How could it not be? They're living in the state, and they're part of it. So, yes, you still hear the rhetoric. But if you speak to people on the ground, and I encourage anyone to read Yehoshua Pfeffer, my wife's colleague at Tikva, Yehoshua Pfeffer, who runs an institute for Haredim in Tikva, you read what he writes, read what Yitzhak Adlerstein writes, and you see that there's a whole Haredi world there. Maybe you call them Haredi Light, the Blue Shirt Haredim, whatever. Not the B'nai Brak hardcore, but the American Haredim who go to Israel really can't fit into that Israeli Haredi mindset, and they do not just see the state as a piggy bank or just a place to get money. That was the old Haredi position. And we see it today, that the Haredi world, Haredim today, to become a dayan, a government dayan, is regarded as a big honor and something they work for. And in fact, the religious Zionists have a big problem now because the dayanim, in many of the rabbinic courts, they're all Haredim. That was never an issue years ago because the Haredim never became dayanim. The Stipor said it's forbidden. So the religious Zionists had the whole courts themselves. You didn't have any conversion issues, all that, because you didn't have any Haredim in the court. When Rav Yoshev becomes the Das Torah, he comes out of that world. He was a dayan himself, and the Hashkafa changes. And now the idea is that you're supposed to. So when they elect now, they have to have three types of dayanim. They have to divide it. Ashkenazi Haredim, Sephardic Shas types, and religious Zionists. I used to say that the religious Zionists, they always would be upset that the Haredim don't want to be part in the Bat Eidin. Be careful what you wish for. It's precisely because now they're part of it that the religious Zionists, many of them don't even want the chief rabbin anymore because they say the Haredim control it. But that really, that's a sign that they want to be part of it. You might not like the results, but if that's what they're doing. Ben says Rav Chaim acted as a social worker, 100%. He acted as a social worker. Not only acted as a social worker, he thought that that's the job of the Rav, is to be the social worker. That's today, as opposed to something that the rabbi looks down upon and someone else could do it, he saw that as the highest achievement. Very much at odds with what most rabbis think their job is. But that was Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim, unlike his son, Rav Elva, who was very austere, Rav Chaim was a very, smiley, joking person. He'd get down on the ground. We have an eyewitness testimony and let the children ride on his back like a horse. And Rav Chaim was a special person. Yana says, the wild animals in New York are mostly tourists and outsiders. I don't know. I have to tell you that it's the tourists and outsiders often being attacked. I have to say that today the animals are, they're not the tourists, but the Rav wasn't speaking about that. The Rav was talking about the machokas. That the Orthodox in New York, the machokas that was constant. You go to a place in Boston, you don't have such machokas. You're out of town. People can live among each other, but New York was always full of machokas, so a lot of tension. So that's what the Rav was referring to. And Nissen says he attended a Friday night talk several years ago by Chazan Ben Zion Miller, who stated that the official Chazan's traditional function on weekdays is to visit the sick. That's interesting. So Rivka says Sipora Roosevelt went to Harvard. That was the story that Atara told. That Yena says, would the Rav been so involved with the Salma family where they're not large contributors? Look, they were contributors, so he was very close to them. He helped them. I'm assuming, if you're in the Rav's community, the Rav's going to take care of everyone in the community. He had a special relationship with them. There was also, they became religious. That's a big responsibility the Rav had, but they became religious because of him. But when you're going to see later, I'll give you another example. And these, as far as I know, these are not big machers or anything like that. But of course, the rabbis always have a connection to the machers because the machers are the ones that help them with their institutions and things. But any real rabbi is not just interested in the machers. In fact, I think you can know the rabbi. The rabbis often know things about the people that no one knows about, at least the good rabbis, the people who are at homebound, things like that. That's the job of the Rav. What can I tell you? Someone privately asked, did I hear an interview, Rabbi Mazlin's interview with Ephraim Goldberg about his relationship with the Rav and the Rav being a Zionist? I didn't, and I don't, it's not for me to interfere in family things. All I could say is that the other part of the family doesn't accept this. So look, at the end of the day, the Rav was not the Brisker Rav, and the Rav was head of the religious Zionists of America. He never withdrew from it, never backed down on it. He wasn't a Rav Kook Zionist, no question about it. When Rabbi Mazman published his essay, Rabbi Yosef Blau published a very strong response. And I don't want to get involved with that. Bruce says, and last question, many Orthodox shuls into the 70s held shul dinners and events with mixed dancing. Yes, that's part of the history of American Orthodoxy. Absolutely. There still might be one or two shuls, maybe Spanish and Portuguese. You can let me know, because into the 2000s, Spanish and Portuguese still had it. And also KJ, as I recall, when Rabbi Berman became rabbi of the Jewish Center, he stopped the dance. And the dance at my shul stopped. It would have been, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, when the rabbi was honored. And he said, well, his rabbinic colleagues are coming, so we should, it's not kavod. So they stopped it that year, and it never started up again. But that was part of the culture. That was the concept wasn't something that was just like the concept of an Eruv, you know, in the 60s, you know, every shul you'd have a, you know, baby carriage. I still remember the baby carriages, you know, in front of the shul. It took a while for this, you know, in all the suburban places, you know, the idea that you have an Eruv, that took a while till people became aware that this was an issue. So, that's part of the history. And, you can listen to Rabbi Mintz. I listened to him. He spoke about Manhattan Eruv, and he said that, the Jewish Center was full of, baby carriages also. Rabbi Lamb came there in 1958 and it was full of baby carriages. And that was one of the motivations to have an Eruv, because the people, these are people that for whatever reason didn't think that that was an issue. But that was, it was an American Orthodoxy that wasn't so learned, but they were committed. And the next generation, there was a necessity. So in the 70s, Eruvin pop up all over America. And that's when you get them to move to the right. No more dances. You have Eruv thing. My shul put on, you can see on YouTube, they put on a performance of Fiddler on the Roof. And, of course, women singing. No shul would do that today. And in those days, all the shuls would have trips to go see Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway. Today, they wouldn't do that either. So, Rivka says, now modern Orthodox weddings have more mixed dancing. And I don't know, it could go back and forth. It depends. What I don't understand about the modern Orthodox weddings, I've been to many of them that have separate, they have like a mechitza down the middle, so men dance on one side, women on the other. But at the Haredi weddings, so the men are on one side, women on the other. If you're going to have men sitting on the side where the women are dancing, I'm not sure I understand what the point of the mechitza is there. So, okay, leave it at that. Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you. I have, okay. I'm not going to comment on that article either, but it was a very, I couldn't finish the article. It was so crazy, but.
So it's a revisionist. It's a revisionist article.
Yeah.
And look, he's from the family, so you have to have, and he knew the Rav. We didn't know the Rav. I mean, I didn't at least, other than a tiny few questions. So, I mean, you can't, you can succumb with authority. On the other hand, but we have all the other members of the Rav's family as well, saying completely opposite. And we have the Rav's public persona. So, what can I say? Yeah.
Okay. Please God, we'll see you next week. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman and Dr. Sokolow are back, of course, after missing Purim, the Chalutzim, back to the early roots of Zionism, right? Rabbi Shulman continuing our Sefer Daniel. This Thursday night's Parsha Shir is Rabbi Kerbel. Judah Kerbel will be giving the Parsha Shir, so making his debut for Torah in Motion, and our regular Shirim during the week. And as I mentioned in the beginning, please God, we're beginning our Pesach program March 22nd, I think. We'll send out details in a few days. Okay, everybody, have a good night. Be well. Shavua Tov. And please invite a friend to join at this or many other classes that we have. Okay? Look forward to hearing from you and seeing you. All right. Laila Tov, everybody.